Hi, I'm Matthew Blades, and learn from people who lived it as a great partner, ASI, or Advanced Systems Integration. They design and install cutting-edge audio and visual equipment. This woman-owned small business is big enough to find a solution for your next corporate build-out or school project, and can even slide in to service your existing system. Bring in ASI and 2 decades of AV experience. I hope you'll visit their website at asi-av.com to see their gallery of work.
Welcome to another episode of Learn from People Who Lived It.
My name is Donna Lowney. I'm 58 years old.
What story are you here to share?
I'm here to share the journey that I have taken with anxiety in my pocket. I'm a person who has suffered lifelong anxiety and panic disorder. The things that I'd like to share are things that have worked for me, things that have frightened me, things that I continue after 40 years to deal with, and the journey then that changed a little as my daughter started hers.
Who do you hope hears this?
I hope anybody who needs to hear it hears it. I hope anybody who is feeling like they are the only one out there who feels anxious about things that don't make sense, that they love, that they don't understand. I hope they hear it and realize that it's not you. You're perfect. You're the person you're meant to be. You are just living with something that you need to get to know, get familiar with, and learn how to make it work for you.
She was 12 years old when she remembers suffering her first bit of anxiety. Wait till we talk about x-rays. Now she's a mom, which didn't come without its own difficulties. And now her own daughter has her struggles too. Therapy, medicine. Let's lay it all out on the line today with Donna. Hi, Donna. Welcome to our podcast.
Hi, Matthew. Thank you so much.
As you would expect, Dr. Frank Bavacqua is joining us on this podcast as well. Good afternoon to you, sir.
Good afternoon.
All right. Well, let's jump right into it. Anxiety is a word that I think we could all three agree. A lot of people are throwing that word around right now. It's starting to get a lot of attention and probably starting to get its due attention because it's a thing that a lot of people have been living with for a long time, yourself included. Donna, when you talk about being 12, when you remember kind of this all bubbling up, we've been starting every podcast with people's 0 to 10. And so can you give me an idea, a little bit of a look into your life, what it's like for you as a little girl in terms of family, birth order, mom, dad, you know, that kind of a vibe?
Sure. I was born into an Italian Catholic family in New York City. Very noisy, as you can imagine. Grandparents, relatives, always over. A very loving home. I'm the oldest of 3 daughters. We are within 5 years of each other. My mom was a speech pathologist and teacher. My dad was an FBI agent. And we moved a couple of times in my very young life up until kindergarten. As my dad graduated from the academy and got his first postings and settled in a suburb of Chicago, Park Forest, Illinois, where we lived until I was about 15. At that time, we were all, you know, stay-at-home mom, very involved in brownies and Girl Scouts and gymnastics and dance lessons and music lessons and just the kind of stuff that very middle-class families did in Park Forest, Illinois in the 70s.
Do you look back on your childhood pretty fondly?
I do. When I was getting my master's, I had to take a class about adolescent psychology, abnormal psychology in adolescence, and we had to kind of write our life stories from a childhood perspective. And I realized that I was very different from other people, which was weird because I thought our family was very much the norm. There was no abuse. There was no drug abuse or alcohol abuse of any kind. That doesn't mean that people didn't go to parties and have drinks, but there is no disease of alcoholism or addiction in my family history. There are no major health issues in my family. Everybody's pretty healthy. There was no verbal, emotional, or physical abuse that I remember being exposed to. My parents, again, being from the East and being largely Italian, if they argued, they argued loudly, but it was never one of those things where we were afraid. It was always, they ended it with a kiss and moved on. I kind of wrote a letter to my mom at that time and said I had no idea how good we had it, because the other people in my class that read their papers about their childhoods had very different stories, some of them quite extreme. And until I was getting my master's, I really just didn't know. I thought that we were all Beaver Cleaver kind of families, right?
Where do you think the first bit of anxiety comes in then? Because, you and I talked about it in our kind of pregame interview, if you will, mm-hmm. that, most people are anxious because they've got a situation at home or school or somewhere else where there's an X factor there. But, for you, there seemingly isn't one. Where are you when this first bit of anxiety starts to bubble up and you start to feel a little different?
It was all around separating from my mom. It was all around going to school. And I can remember just sheer and utter panic, almost like terror and no reason behind it. Kind of just being like, I don't get it. And she had no idea what to do with it. And I was crying. I had headaches. I would fight about going to school, which was just not a thing, back then. I loved school. I loved my teachers. I was a good student. I wanted to be a teacher, and I am. And it made no sense. It was just like, what is happening? And of course, this is the mid to late 70s, and I was emotional or hysterical or sensitive, or they even scanned my brain for a tumor because my headaches were so bad. They were looking for a medical explanation when there wasn't one. And the words anxiety disorder didn't exist back then, certainly not for 11 and 12 year olds. My mom, I remember later in my life, her telling me that she had anxiety that was unidentified, obviously, as a young person and all her life, and not debilitating. She still, walked through her life, and, you put on, pull up your big girl pants, as they say, and you just get on with it. And that's the generation that she grew up in. And so that's certainly what she did. But my house was a very open place to talking about it and wondering what was going on. And she did talk to my doctor, and it was just something that didn't get identified until much later.
Dr. Frank, I'd like to bring you into the conversation just to talk a little bit about anxiety from, the psychologist's standpoint. Is it very often that you see somebody who is real anxious and seemingly doesn't have much going on, in terms of trauma, or are these things more common than I would think?
You said it earlier where the word anxiety gets thrown around a lot, and we use it to mean a lot of different things. Sort of the true definition of anxiety in a clinical sense is it's not necessarily tied to a cause. Sometimes we are anxious about certain things, but as Donna was describing, she's like, well, I liked school. There was no reason why all of a sudden I should be fearful about going to school or leaving home. And that's obviously when there's something a little bit different going on, as opposed to somebody who's being bullied at school and now has a very sort of obvious reason why they don't want to be there that day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And this is great conversation because we need to learn more about these things. As people start tossing around words like anxiety, it's important that we understand what they mean, where they come from, and all of that stuff. So Donna, all the x-rays to figure out what's wrong with you, that in itself, you can say what you will, but that there is a little bit of a stinging effect that happens there, right? As people are working on you,
yeah,
making you feel like something is wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how are you handling those moments?
I felt like there was something wrong with me.
Yeah.
I was a smart little girl with lots of friends and who loved school and teachers. And all of a sudden I could not manage my life anymore. And I thought, okay, well, good thing they're doing this, because certainly I must figure out why I've completely lost it. And I like what the doctor had to say, as I've always kind of looked at it as I have anxiety and depression. Anxiety, big A, little A. Depression, big D, little D. And I kind of look at it as anxiety and depression are clinical diagnoses. They are, you know, in simple terms, having to do with brain chemistry. And that's at least the way my doctor, who finally got on top of it in my 30s, described it. We all have little A, little D, anxiety and depression. When we're sad about an event that's happened or anxious about something that's coming up, like today, doing this, getting ready, making sure everything was on. I had little A anxiety. I wasn't having a panic attack, but I had the good kind of nervous where I was anticipating something that I've never done before, didn't know what to expect, and was excited and nervous and all of that stuff. Anxiety for me was something medical that I did hope that they figured something out, because it wasn't me. It wasn't like the real me that loved life, that was an active girl in my Girl Scouts and in my life in softball and with my family and with our giant circle of friends that we had formed around us in Illinois. And so, yeah, I was looking at it like, oh, okay. You know, they did allergy tests and all kinds of things to mm-hmm. try and figure out what's causing these headaches. But it did never even began to zero in on why is she crying? Why is she so scared? And again, then it was more like maybe the medical cause is making her anxious, and she's sensitive. She's a very sensitive girl. And that part was a little frustrating.
We did not have great ways to describe the things that happened to us a couple of decades ago. Mm-hmm. I don't think people realize how new psychology is in general. You know, we can ballpark about 100 years, which seems like a lot, but in the grand scheme of things really isn't. You know, even if you think of, you know, veterans and PTSD, you know, it was shell shock, right? We didn't have a word for it. We didn't have a way to describe it. It's really only been the last couple of decades that we start to like sort of wrap our heads around how to understand and explain stuff. And Donna, the explanation that you just gave, big A, little A, big D, little D, like that, I hesitate to say perfect explanation that anyone out there can sort of understand and wrap their head around. And we just did not have those words a couple of decades ago. Which kind of stinks, because you want to be able to wrap your head around what the heck is happening.
Yeah, because I can imagine there was a lot of people that went to the doctor and felt worse when they left.
Yeah.
A lot of people that left feeling worse. Did you have a lot of times where you left feeling worse while they were trying to manage all this? Yeah, right.
And I was very, very lucky in the sense that the doctors weren't the only people that we relied on. At the time I mentioned, you know, that when I was younger, we were active in our church, and the priests were close to my family. And my parents, particularly my mother, who understood it better, was very on top of this, you know, there's not something wrong with you. This is how you are. And this is part of who you are. And we're going to figure out, you know, what is it that's hurting inside you, and how to fix it. Because yeah, I for a long time, like the doctor mentioned earlier, I'm not a victim of trauma. I mean, since then, I've had a traumatic event or two in my life, but certainly not as an 11-year-old who lived in a very functional family. And even all along as a growing adult, I'm a teacher in a very low-income, high-crime neighborhood. My students are victims of trauma. And we see that in their day-to-day functioning, and have taken extensive training on how to address that. That's not me. That's something different. the way people respond to trauma is different than what I deal with, which is, you know, brain chemistry that's gone wonky or wasn't set up right to begin with or whatever. Certainly certain situations can make it worse. Some can make it better. But I have lucked into a therapist or two and my medical doctor that I had in the last decade or so that just sort of said, has anybody ever just explained this to you? And I was like, not really. I mean, I've kind of come to the understanding that, I mean, I had full-blown panic attacks and thought, well, that's it. I've just lost it. You know, I'm nuts. And it feels like you're dying. And you know, you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning when nothing is going on. I'm asleep. And bam, it hits you like a hammer in the chest. And everybody's panic attacks are different. Mine involved convulsions, inability to breathe, heart racing. I couldn't talk without gasping. And I thought, oh, well, here, this is how it ends. Here I am alone in my apartment at 3 a.m. You know, I'm 35 and that's it. And it turns out that wasn't it, obviously. And I found a good therapist and my doctor who said, well, you know, here's how you're different from other people. And, oh, well, okay. And there's some medicine that can help with that. Fantastic.
It's a good conversation. No, it really is a good conversation to have right now, because listen, while sometimes we throw pills out for the wrong reasons, there are a lot of people who are in your shoes who it is a chemical imbalance, and getting a little bit of, like, I'm not heading into your world, but getting a little serotonin, or you doing all the things that all the medicines do. But that can turn the light on for people and legitimately turn them into the best versions of themselves, because everything is firing all cylinders, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, but we don't. It's so weird to me, because you go to the doctor, you get the flu, and you'll take any medicine he'll give you, and you'll take it all. And if that doesn't work, you'll try another medicine. But like, when we have these chemical imbalances, and maybe that's what it is, a legitimate chemical imbalance, we are so strange about taking pills. And I remember when I was going through my journey, and I'm still on a low dose, something to kind of, you know, ride out this thing as I'm newer into my journey. But I remember going through a bunch of different medicines during the time to try to figure out which one was going to work or which one was going to be the fit and the whole thing. And it was a real mental battle for me. And in hindsight, I'm not sure how much of that was society speaking and how much of that was me speaking, you know, and you know, all the other things. And then I think, and maybe I'm wrong about this, Donna, but you go through this thing where you're like, God, I wish, why do I have to be the one to take the medicine? Why do I have to be the one that has to take the medicine to be okay? You know? And I'm just talking about the struggles that come along with popping a pill in your mouth.
It's such a mental health. I mean, I think that's an enormous conversation, you know, and we're just scratching the surface here. Don't you agree? And it's just such a stigma for some people, you know, for a lot of people to say, well, you know, she takes medication for that. And I want to say, and I have been since I've been going through this in my own little small circle way. Hey, I take medication for that and it really helps me. And it makes me a participant in my life and in the lives of others. I'm a helper by nature, and I can't live a full and satisfying life if I can't get out of bed. If I had diabetes, nobody would be, you know, stigmatizing my insulin. You know, if I had cancer, nobody would say, well, don't have that chemo. You know, it's just a medication for a mental medical illness. The only thing that can make a panic attack worse is to have anxiety about the panic attack. And I had been doing that all my life. I had felt it coming and gone, oh no, here it comes. And oh shoot, and what do I do? And I need to stop it. And there's just no stopping it. Your body is reacting the way it's being told to react. And I just needed to breathe and have someone distract me, and eventually it subsides. And my little mantra was, you know, I'm not dying. It feels like you are, but you're not. You're not having a heart attack. You're not dying. Just keep breathing. It's going to be okay. You're coming around. Here we go. Oh, see, you're already breathing better.
Were you stressed out to get off your medicine to become pregnant? Like
a little bit.
Yeah, I can imagine that being a real thing, right? It's like, and that's such a conundrum, because you're like, okay, I want to go off the medicine because I know that's the thing I'm supposed to do for the pregnancy, but that's going to result in some other situations, and it must have been really tough to go through it. Okay, so it's unfortunate that you have this miscarriage, but you guys eventually try again, and you have because you told me you have a child of your own now, right?
Who's
nine, or you have two kids.
Well, I have Zach. My stepson is 28, and my daughter Rosie is 19. So this was, 20 years ago that this was happening, and yes. So we did eventually, not too long after, a couple, 3 months after, I got pregnant again, carried her to term, and have a lovely, beautiful daughter. And that was it. The factory was shutting down. Just, I'm a special education teacher, and I was over the age of 35, and that's high risk for certain things.
It makes sense.
And so I was like, okay, we did great one time. That's it. We're good. And so I have a little kid. The nine that you're thinking of is when Rosie first started having panic attacks, when she was nine.
You see a lot of that, Dr. Frank Bavacqua. You see a lot of kids that have panic attacks and anxiety. And if so, what seems to be the trigger for those folks?
I mean, there's both a genetic and environmental component, right? I think we can all think of, if we didn't ourselves, we can probably think of people that we know who grew up in a very sort of high stress environment, right? And so, parents feel or act a certain way and create this environment that almost sort of creates that anxiety in their kids, because they have to live in that same environment every single day. In this case, it seems just to be more of a genetic thing, right? It's no different than you have brown eyes, so your kid is a little more likely to have brown eyes. It's that simple. And it doesn't sound like there was necessarily an environmental trigger, but yeah, there's absolutely a genetic component. It just kind of happens.
And does that break your heart as a mom? Because you kind of feel like, oh my God, my girl is going to go through everything I went through. At least that's what you think in your head, right?
Sure. Absolutely. The doctor's correct. It was definitely a situation where I was aware of the fact that environmentally I could make anxiety a thing in our house. And we are a very chill family on the outside to anybody who knows us. We like fun, but we also are we take our relaxation very seriously. We take our time out very seriously. And I remember friends who were a little high strung during their pregnancies and worried about this and worried about that. And they had these colicky babies, at those first few months, a lot of crying and stuff. And I thought, no, not me. And every day I'd get home from work and I'd sit and I'd meditate. And the whole time, breathe in, I'd say, good eater, and breathe out, good sleeper, and just in and out. And I just focus on, she was going to be a healthy child, good eater, good sleeper. Don't care if she's ugly. She just needs to be, healthy. Don't care if she's not very smart, just as long as everything is. But it turns out I have a beautiful, smart, talented child who struggles with anxiety and panic disorder.
So that must bring up a little anxiety in you, right? Seemingly that's what happens. And I'm certain that there's other moms who are on this podcast listening, or parents in general, who have kids that deal with anxiety, because this is a whole other thing. And anybody who has kids knows that. It's like, oh man, it's one thing for me to have it, but for my child to now suffer from it, because like we said a few minutes ago, your head goes to all the places you've ever been. And if you're not careful, you throw all your stuff on them, and hold up, because, maybe now we have medicine. Maybe she won't have any of these experiences that you had. But, what is your life like as a mom with a kid who's got anxiety?
Well, as I've mentioned before, I'm Italian and Catholic, so the guilt is enormous. however, I'm also, aware that guilt is kind of not a very constructive emotion. And so, Rosie And I, you know, for those who are worried, my daughter has given permission for me to speak about her using her name. Ro is a really, was a happy little girl. She was hilarious. But I saw myself in her in the sense that she is very independent, didn't like other people telling her what to do. And in a five-year-old, that's kind of tricky to parent, but I was just sort of hoping that that would make her, you know, a really self-thinking teenager and less swayed by peer pressure, I was hoping, and actually turned out to be true. But so Ro went to the school where I taught, and damned if it wasn't the exact same thing, anxiety about separating from me and going to school. And she loved school, and she had the most amazing, giving, loving teachers who absolutely rode this ride with us, who would take her in their arms and give her a hug and help her get through the morning. But she, part of the difficulty is that she knew I was down the hall, and all she wanted was me. And so we, you know, we had to make some rules that she couldn't come see me. If they took her to the nurse, and the nurse was very good at helping her talk through it, helping her, you know, get back on the path of I can get on with my day, I could not go down there. So yeah, it was really difficult at first. I would cry, you know, myself. It was so hard to watch. And when we spoke to a therapist when she was about 9 or 10 years old, they recommended medication. They wanted to put her on Zoloft. And at that time, it just terrified me. And I'm a person who's taking medication and knows that it works for me, but she was 9. And I just wasn't there yet as her mom. I hadn't seen a whole lot of studies, and I had asked her doctor and her therapist, you know, what's out there about the effects of this down the road for children as young as her. And there wasn't really anything.
Yeah, I understand that. That to me seems like a very legitimate fear as a parent to, you know, what am I putting into my child? So eventually you get to a stage where you decide you're going to go down that route. What's the tipping point for you?
Well, so on we go, and we handle the rest of elementary school. And it sounds ridiculous to say, you know, now, because while we were in it, it just seemed like the worst thing that could happen to a little person. But she got through okay. You know, for the most part, she did fine. She started playing volleyball. You know, she had been in dance already. So she found the two loves of her life, those two things. And she was immersed in them. And funny enough, her first dance recital, you know, the moms weren't allowed back. It was the dance school had their yearly recital at Scottsdale Center for the Arts. So it was a big stage with a big audience. And but moms, you know, dropped off their kids at the back room where the volunteer moms were back there putting them in costume, making sure their makeup was right. And I'm, you know, walked out to the audience and said to my husband, she's not going to get out on that stage. We're not going to see her. We're going to be sitting here watching her group, and she won't be there. I can't imagine that she's going to be able to do it. And, you know, I was, you know, panicking, legs shaking, and waiting while their little number came up. And sure enough, the song starts and all the little girls run out on the stage, and there she was. And she had a look on her face like, not so sure. But the minute the dance started, she lost herself, and she was in the dance, and she just was going and grinning. And I cried with relief. And so we found some physical outlets for her. She has never, ever been nervous getting on stage to dance or go into a volleyball tournament, which, you know, you figure those are high pressure situations. So that would be the perfect time to have a panic attack.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah, the one person that we haven't really talked about along the way is your husband. And so I just wonder, as a family unit, how's he getting along with all this? What's, you know, as just as you are talking about how you're handling it with her, how's he handling it with her?
Oh, bless his heart. That our little girl, our 19-year-old adult girl, he just thinks she hung the moon, and he's just her daddy, and he's her protector, and he can't bear to see her cry, to see her anxious, to watch what it does to her, because she still struggles. Hers is different than mine. And so just going through that with her, you watch it just kill him, but he is the most supportive. He has been to her psychiatry appointments with her, with me. We have talked to doctors together. We're a team in this. This is not mom handling everything because she knows what's going on, and dad's just, you know, keeping his job for the health insurance. This is, mm-hmm. all of us are in it. And Tim has a little experience with anxiety as well, not necessarily big A anxiety, more situational, you know. So there are periods in his life where he feels like he remembered feeling anxious and unsure, and but never panic attacks, never, you know, the stuff of medication, you know. And so he understands it. He has an understanding of it, in the extent that, you know, he's suffered just a touch of it, and has enough empathy and enough understanding to kind of realize that, well, then what they must go through is so much more difficult. And for his daughter, it's, she has her biggest cheerleader, the guy that will do anything to make her smile and to help her relieve her pain.
I want to ask on behalf of other parents who have kids that are dealing with anxiety and haven't found their solution yet, as you guys were going through different modalities to try to find something that would work for her, can you speak to that process a little bit, and maybe a couple of things that you found that were positive, and maybe some things that you'd say, you know, and I wouldn't waste your time with that.
Sure. First thing I would say is, I can't recommend what people would waste their time with. What works for us as a family, or my daughter as a person, could totally be a bust for somebody else, and vice versa. Like we found, Tim and I found this great podcast by a guy, and I don't remember it, or I would promote it here, but it was a couple of years ago. When Rosie was in high school, the anxiety got really bad. And so we started with a psychiatrist, and right before freshman year, she did start medication. Don't be afraid of medication, I would say. I mean, stay right on top of it, do your research, talk to your medical providers, but don't be afraid. And breathing, and people always just laugh, well, yeah, okay, duh. But no, like breathing the right way, like into your belly, and doing the 4 second in and the hold and the breathe out through your mouth, and having some kind of positive words you say to yourself. For me, I like just counting, like the numbers and the repetitiveness of the counting are very just soothing to me. For my daughter, she says to herself, I'm not dying, and then lets it out, you know, breathe in, I'm not dying, breathe out, I'm okay, it's going to be all right. So the breathing for sure. Tim and I thought we found this, you know, silver bullet podcast, a young man who lived with anxiety, was super relatable. Like, oh, we were listening to it. She was like, I don't like that. I was like, Tim was like, what? God, he's so cool. And she was like, yeah, you listen to it, Dad. I'm not into it.
Yeah, right.
A therapist, you know, yes. And I think people need to know, and I hope Dr. Frank, I'm just avoiding your last name because I'm not sure I would say it right.
Most people can't. Don't worry.
It's Italian.
It is Italian. I know, but I keep, I don't have it in front of me, so I can't read it. So
to me, it sounds like a pastry. Bavacqua.
Bavacqua. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I hope Dr. Bavacqua would agree that sometimes when you're looking for the correct therapist or the correct psychiatrist or both, you the first hit might not be the right one.
And oh, absolutely.
So not to be afraid to say, okay, thank you very much for your time, and then try someone else.
Right. And I mean, I think the key part there is, and then try someone else. There are so many times, you know, friends of mine, family, probably people that, you know, people that we all know, like, you know, you try so hard to get them to go see someone because we know ultimately that's going to be beneficial for them. And the first person they sit down in front of, just, they don't click. Mm-hmm. And they're like, see, this is why I didn't do it. Therapy doesn't work, or fill in the blank doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the key part is, and then try again, because please, someone will work, and it's totally worth it.
Exactly. For myself, I can say that the first one was a super nice lady, and I loved talking with her, but she just kept telling me how right I was. And I was kind of like, well, I know I'm right. I just need to,
like, I'm trying to figure something out, right?
I'm the most right person, you know. Well, at the time I was, you know, getting married and becoming a step parent. So I kind of went with that intent. Like, I didn't want to be breaking somebody else's kid. And so, you know, there's a whole lot of blending and mixing, and there's a mom involved and other family members. And how do I do this and, like, save myself from the criticism, which, you know, you get as a step parent. And then also to not, like, put this child in the middle of anything toxic. And so it was like, oh, you're totally right. You shouldn't have to go through that. And I was like, yeah, I know I'm right, but help me, you know, what do I do? And so then the second guy, thought that the way to do it was to talk to me about his anxiety, which was relatable at first, you know. Then I was like, okay, cool. Like, it's the whole, I'm not alone factor. But then, you know, 3, 4, 5 appointments of that, it's kind of like, okay, but I need to figure out what I need to do.
And you're paying him so he can just tell you his story. It's fantastic.
Right. I mean, maybe I'll relate and do what he does. Right. I don't know. But then, you know, the one I finally hit on was, you know, the gal who gave me homework, who drew pictures on her whiteboard, who gave me articles to read and assignments to do with my husband. And she was like tickled pink, because when I came back, I'm a teacher, dang it, I did my homework. and she was just like, oh, yeah, you did it. And I'm like, of course I did it. Don't be ridiculous. Why would I waste your time or mine? So
I can speak from being on the other side of that couch. There are a lot of people who don't do the homework.
Well, right.
So, yeah.
And why go?
I mean, the funny answer is, you know, why waste your time? Why waste your money? But the big picture is, you know, for every 10 people that you sit across from, maybe 9 of them don't do the homework, but maybe for those 9, that was the first step. And right, somewhere down the road, they're going to do somebody else's homework. And then right, that's going to be their moment. So yeah, it's really easy to close the door after somebody leaves and be like, why are they even here?
Right.
But showing up is a win in itself.
That is why you're the professional, because there you are giving those people that say, well, and for some people, just the talking to somebody,
yeah,
like is the part they needed, and someone who will hear them and listen to them. For my daughter, it's been a harder, you know, we're talking about at the time we were looking for our first therapist, an adolescent girl. So even though Ro has anxiety, she is still very normal in every other way. And so therefore adults are stupid and she knows everything. And so it was just like, the first lady was the sweetest, very grandmotherly, but kind of did the same thing as I had the first time. She's like, well, mom, all she did was keep telling me, well, you're right. You're such a nice person and it's okay. And she's like, yeah, I know that. I just need to, like, not throw up in class, because that's Rosie's. That's how Rosie manifests anxiety. She's a barfer. And
she gets sick. Yeah.
She gets sick. And so, you know, in middle school, it's hard to be known that you know, as the kid who threw up in the planter outside of English.
Aww.
But, you know, and now she's 19 and we find humor in it. And that's also a big part of our family. Mm-hmm. We laugh like hysterical idiots and people think that we're just unwell, you know? So, so there's that. We just have to, like, oh my gosh, mommy, remember the time that you, yes. And I'm a full on owner of all of my awkwardness, and I will take it. And if it'll make her laugh, I will do it again. And so Yes. So do we joke about, you know, oh, well, you know, in middle school, Rosie was that kid, and we all go the barfer, and, you know, everybody laughs and Rosie cracks up and she'll even joke about it with her friends. But she's, you know, she's been on a tough journey, and it absolutely is, you know, rough as a parent to watch that, but definitely learning how to breathe right. Definitely finding some kind of physical, for us, the physical activity has been a godsend. You know, I'm sure Dr. Bavakwa can explain to us why that works, you know, the endorphins and things like that, the chemicals that build up in your body when you're doing the thing, the physical, whether it be working out at the gym, which my husband is very an advocate of, it just helps him manage his stress. Or for Rosie, it was dancing and playing volleyball. And those physical outlets, you know, help her manage her anxiety. Now we've noticed an uptick in the anxiety because she is not in high school anymore. So she's not playing volleyball, and she's this semester, she is not dancing. She was when she started college, she is not at the moment. And we are definitely seeing an uptick in symptoms. And so I'm sure you can speak to how having some sort of physical outlet is really helpful.
To find your outlet is one of the biggest blessings, right? I mean, there's lots of help out there, but to find what your outlet is, and you're exactly, you can tell that you have been a good student along the way of your own sort of treatment as you've experienced it, because you're able to relay things back to us in a way that I think not everybody is able to do. So kudos to you for being able to do that. And you're right, there is a literal benefit to physical activity. The tie that I make that I think is sometimes missed, you know, you had mentioned before that like meditation is one of the things that you inserted into your life because mm-hmm. you found benefits from it. And the thing that I try to point out to folks is an activity that is meditative can be almost as good as actual meditation. So being on stage, dancing, playing mm-hmm. a sport, you know, by definition, meditative meaning when you're doing that thing, that's the only thing that you're thinking about.
You're talking about being in the zone.
Yeah.
Going to a different place.
Right. You can call it being in the zone, call it flow, call it meditative, right? When you're doing that thing, it's the only thing that you're thinking about. It's the only thing that you're focused on. And that is an amazing benefit.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, not everybody finds that. And sometimes, like in your daughter's case, those things exist for a certain period of time. And then when we move on to, say, college from high school, maybe those same opportunities don't exist anymore. So we have to find it again.
Exactly.
And that's never fun to try to find it again, because we found it. We had it. It worked.
Right.
Why did it go away?
Right. And yeah, and she's discovered the gym. And I'm a person who is not a gym person. It makes me feel ways that I don't like to feel about myself, so I don't go. If I'm walking, I'm hiking, we have a treadmill and some weights at home. And if, you know, I'm feeling like sweat is the answer, then that's what I'll do. But Ro has gone to the gym with her dad and learned, you know, safe ways to do exercise for her body. And that now she'll go with friends. Well, if she was sitting here today, she would say to you, that helps me manage my anxiety 100%. Just getting the sweat on, and definitely a meditative activity. Ro is not a sitter and meditator. Ro is a mover. She gets in what Matthew referred to as the zone. Rosie's jam, you know, is just, she's a creator. So she's a choreographer. So when she just puts on music and pushes all the, you know, we put down wood floor in the big living room in our house, so that could be where she creates. And that's where she goes. She moves all the furniture. It's all on wheels. And she just lets it go. And so for her, that's her. For me, I write, or I do a creative thing. I like to learn things. So I read about the stuff that I'm interested in or that I need to tackle. I do some research. I'm learning how to, trying to teach myself how to play guitar.
Get out.
It's a little tricky, but, and I have to carve out that time. And, you know, as I mean, we all live in reality as well, and we're working and we got kids, and we got family and we got obligations and it's a pandemic and God help us all. But it's, you know, right now, we are both, and what I'm so proud of, I've been very open with my family, but also people who are not family about what I deal with. And people always are like, what, you know, you, I come off as confident. I'm loud. I've been doing what I do for a really long time. So in the world of teaching, I'm not a very, you know, I don't sit back and let people, you know, roll over me. I'm a special education teacher. So I'm a very vocal advocate for my students. People are really surprised to, because they, I think they associate anxiety with that meekness. You know what I mean? Like that. And that's not me. I've learned a lot and I'm well managed on my medication. And I learned, because like I said, I was off while I was pregnant. Once Rosie was born, I was off while I was nursing. And then all those hormones settled down. I never had a panic attack while I was pregnant. I didn't have any anxiety while I was the happiest, saddest person you ever saw in your life. And then the hormones settled. And that weird feeling when you wake up in the morning and you realize, oh, life is here. And, you know, my foot starts to wiggle and I'm just like, oh, it's coming back. And I was just determined. Okay. I think the hardest thing for me, because I am a person that lives in my head a lot. I am an intellectual. I study a lot. I love to learn. And I know in my head what's going on and why can't I control this? Why can I, me and my big fat brain, why can't I get on top of this? And right around that time that the anxiety started creeping back after Rosie was born, I was like, well, shit. And my little Italian mom, who bless her heart, is still living, by the way, shrinking by the minute, but said to me, you know what, Rosie doesn't care if her mom takes a pill in the evening. What Rosie cares about is a present and loving and happy mother. And so you need to get back. You need to do what you need to do. Talk to your doctor, see what he recommends. And so when I talked to my doctor, he goes, okay, so what we know is that this is something that you will likely be on for the rest of your life, because it's just part of you. And I love what Dr. B said there a few minutes ago. It's part of Lila, like my brown eyes, like my curly, uncontrollable hair that I finally stopped fighting with in my 50s. You know, and I think that's the place we need to get everybody else. Yes. And like Matthew, yours is maybe not from a chemical imbalance in your brain. You've maybe had situations that have brought on the panic and the anxiety. There are a lot of people that have that. And even if it's not that, and it is someone like me who has a chemical imbalance that needs to be treated with chemicals, it needs to just be okay.
I don't care why it's there. You just can't ignore it. You gotta try to solve the problem, because what ends up happening if you don't is everybody suffers around you.
Exactly.
You know, and most people are nice people and they don't want to do that to other people. Right. So
no,
it's about working on yourself. If you could look back now and just kind of give us a summary and a wrap up commentary about anxiety as a whole and how you manage it. What's the lesson? What has this thing taught you in your family about how you want to be, how you want to live life?
Wow. Well, certainly for me and for my daughter, it's a lifelong journey, and I don't use the word struggle. I'm not going to struggle against something that is part of me. It's futile. So for my family, it's something that exists. It is something that is part of our DNA. And we are choosing in the healthiest way possible, and will continue to choose in the healthiest way possible, to get to know it. It's part of us. And we're going to, like, I've gotten to know my heart, and I've gotten to know, you know, other things in my life. I have gotten to know my anxiety and how I can make it work for me. anxiety for me, now that I've done a lot of work to understand it and to manage the chemical deficiencies with medication, anxiety for us is something that kind of makes us productive. You know, we're kind of, our brains are clicking 90 miles an hour. And so make it work for you. Use what it makes you feel and use it as fuel. You know, help it bring you success. Let it help you help other people. If you see
stop
someone
fighting it, I guess, right? Stop.
Yeah, for sure. If you see someone who's having a struggle and it looks familiar to you, I can't tell you how many floors I've sat on with young people who are just starting, you know, the journey that we have been on for some time. Myself for 40 years or more, for my daughter, you know, half her life. And the proudest moment I think of my life was when she was at volleyball practice as a junior and she was playing on varsity and the freshmen were practicing on the court next to them. And one of the freshmen began having a panic attack and ran off the court and crumpled into a ball onto the floor, off to the side. Rosie recognized it for what it was, went over, put her arms around her, spoke quietly into her ear and gently just stroked her back and just talked to her until it passed and looked her in the eyes and said, "Friend, I feel you. I've been where you've been. Talk to someone. You just had a panic attack." And she said, "Why do I feel like that? I'm playing volleyball. I love it." And she said, "Who knows?" She says, "I'm here to tell you that it can come on you with no notice. And just talk to your mom, find out what you need to do, get on it. But I'm here if you need me."
Here's what I noticed with Donna, and maybe you noticed this too, and I really picked up on it. I liked it, man. Boy, her life has been about support. Everywhere she turns, she seemed to have the right people in her ear, you know?
Which is not the case with everybody.
It is so, she's almost an anomaly, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's unbelievable to listen to somebody who's like, "Well, I didn't really have much trauma. I seem to have good people in my life.
I mean, she called herself an anomaly. And she didn't even sort of realize it until, you know, other people's stories sort of came to light for her.
And I think it is, she does shed light on something that's critically important, which is this stigma over drugs to, you know, and I get it. We're all trying to walk this fine balance, right? Because we do understand on some levels that we're throwing pills at people who really don't need medication. Mm-hmm. But then there's some people that do.
Yeah.
And if you're one of those people, boy, maybe you should go. Yeah. Maybe you should try it.
I think a big part of why we are doing this podcast is to normalize the things that happen to people, right? Because odds are for every one story that we tell, there could be hundreds or thousands of people who had similar experiences, if not really, really close. With mental health, there is that stigma of, I should be able to just be stronger on my own, you know, pharmaceutical intervention or somebody sitting across from me talking to me. Those are indications that I, you know, I can't do this on my own. And when it's happening between our own ears, we feel like we should have control over that. And I think that's the biggest piece. We are fooled into thinking that we have control or should have control over something that we don't actually have control over. The control that we do have is, what do we do about it? How do we go about fixing it? I hesitate to use the word solve it, but how do we manage it? She used the word manage.
Yeah,
I think
like
that's a great
manage,
word.
Right.
But yeah, we trick ourselves into thinking that we have control over the problem. And at best we have control over, you know, the solution or the management moving forward.
Because the struggle in what I want to say is the struggle is trying to manage it yourself. The struggle is trying to own it. Whereas I think what I'm hearing is you sort of need to let go and understand that this, and I like how she put it. It's like, hey, this is just a thing. We're going to have this our whole lives. This is going to be something we need to roll with. Mm-hmm. And I like what she said there at the end. Like, we kind of use it as jet fuel. It's like our little superpower, mm-hmm. you know? And I love that idea of turning the thing that some would see as a weakness or a deficiency into your superpower, mm-hmm. and making that what makes you special,
right,
and different.
I mean, acceptance is hard, right? Like we don't want to accept sometimes as something that we view as an imperfection. But when you get there, life gets easier.
So what do you say to somebody who's in, you know, in your office talking about anxiety and depression and is just confused?
Anxiety is that thing that happens in our head, right? Our mind is racing. There's a million thoughts. A lot of them are very negative and or scary. And when we keep them to ourselves and we try to figure it out ourselves, the increase in burden from that, kind of like what she said earlier about feeling anxious about feeling anxious,
right?
That meta anxiety, it adds a layer that makes it a whole lot harder to dig out from. Once you say it out loud, once you write it down, once it gets out of your head, it doesn't quite hold the same amount of power anymore. And I learned a long time ago, even little things, right? Like being nervous about walking out on stage, being nervous about getting on an airplane, being nervous even about, you know, I'm packing for a trip and I feel like I forgot something, right? But just sort of saying out loud, I think I might have forgotten something, but you know, I have the three things that I absolutely need, and anything else that I forgot, I can buy. And once you just sort of say those things out loud, it takes the power away from whatever's swirling around in your head. Because I promise you, 99 times out of 100, whatever is swirling around in your head is worse than whatever the reality could be.
We have three goals with Learn from People Who Lived It. 1, to help you feel less alone. 2, encourage you to seek out a coach, a therapist, a church, anyone who can help you get through your journey and find some healing. 3, when you're ready, share your story with us.
Thank you for listening to Learn from People Who Lived It. A reminder again that ASI, or Advanced Systems Integration, designs and installs cutting-edge audio and visual equipment. This woman-owned small business is big enough to find an AV solution for your next boardroom, classroom, council chambers, or courtroom. Bring in ASI and 2 decades of AV experience. Visit ASI-AV.com to see their gallery of work.